If you go to a car dealership these days, you may well encounter a salesman who's asking, "What do I have to do to get you into a car rebate today?" Dealers have been promoting the Cash for Clunkers program for weeks, talking about the $4,500 in government money available for those who trade in an old gas guzzler for a new, more efficient car, even if only slightly more efficient. The new program has been around for nearly a month, but no money's been paid out. The Department of Transportation has been busy writing the rules which are designed to help the auto industry, and those rules are finally due out today. Here's NPR's Jeff Brady.
As car sales plummeted in the last year, there was little for the dealin' Dougs and famous Eds across the country to feel good about. But something called the Car Allowance Rebate System, better known as Cash for Clunkers, has their creative juices flowing again.
This is so exciting! Cash for Clunkers is starting now at Antwerp and Honey!
This ad from a Baltimore car dealer shows a man taking a sledgehammer to an older GM car.
And he keeps smashing the window!
But even with a cracked windshield and now numerous dents,
it's still worth over $4,500 at Antwerp and Hyundai, where Jack says, yes!
Actually, it could be worth that at just about any new car dealership in the country. 1,500 miles away at Emek Volkswagen in Denver, the atmosphere is a bit more dignified. Still, Fred Emek is not above accepting government help for his industry.
We've actually been doing some cash for clunker deals already.
That's a bit risky because rules governing the program won't be out until later today. But Emek says customers came in asking about it and he didn't want to lose sales. His employees have made sure that each deal fits the criteria already known. The car has to be under 25 years old and get less than 18 miles per gallon. The customer also must have owned the car for more than a year, kept it insured, and it has to be running. Emek has questions about that last requirement.
You know, there's obviously different levels of a vehicle running. You know, can it get around the block or can it make it from here to Kansas?
He hopes the rules will clarify that. He also wonders exactly how he's supposed to dispose of the old cars. The law says they have to be destroyed. That's where people like Alice Corns come in. She's president of Colorado Auto and Parts. You might call her a junkyard owner. She refers to herself as an auto recycler. Out on her 40-acre property, there's a big yellow machine that has a blue Pontiac inside. One of her employees walks over and flips a switch.
Right now, he's having to turn on the crusher.
Within a few seconds, the car is squished into a block of metal that's ready for scrap. Corns also is anxiously waiting for the rules due out today because she has questions of her own. Before crushing a car and recycling the metal, she sells the parts that are still usable. That's how she makes money. Corns already knows the law bars her from selling the engine or drivetrain from a clunker.
For a lot of recyclers, selling a good running engine is a lot of where their money comes from. So that puts a bit of hurt on the industry.
But she wants to know specifically what she can sell and still comply with the law. Back at Emek Volkswagen, Fred Emek says he's already discovered an unexpected trend among those coming in to take advantage of this new program.
It's been bizarre because I was expecting, you know, low income, poor credit, you know, stuff like that, and it's been the complete opposite.
Instead, Emek says most of the customers are middle class, thrifty types with good credit. He says a few were even able to pay cash for their new car. The Cash for Clunkers program runs through November 1st or until the $1 billion appropriated for it runs out. Jeff Brady, NPR News, Denver.
And you can learn more about the Cash for Clunkers program at npr.org.
The dairy industry has been hit hard by the recession. Falling milk prices have forced some longtime dairy farmers to shut down and sell their herds for slaughter. The crisis is especially acute in California, the nation's number one milk-producing state. Sasha Coca of member station KQED has this story.
It's an iconic California landscape. Cows graze amid meadows bursting with yellow lupin. In the distance, the windswept cliffs of Point Reyes plunge into the Pacific.
It looks pretty now, but you ought to see when it's real green. And those black holes seams of the green grass and the ocean in the background. Wow.
That's Joey Mendoza, whose grandfather came from the Azores and started this dairy north of San Francisco almost a century ago. Mendoza still lives in the family's historic farmhouse.
Hey, hey.
Workers call the cows in for the morning milking, and 450 Holsteins shuffle into a barn where they're hooked up to a computerized system.
Like that cow, for example, gave 10.2 pounds of milk. Just got done milking, they're going to go out and eat grain, and then they'll eat hay.
For years, the Mendozas have sold their milk to a cooperative that supplies Safeway. But this milking parlor is about to shut down. These cows have purple tags in their ears, indicating they've been sold for slaughter.
I'm going to take you down there and show you the other end of the ranch.
Mendoza's 65, and he looks like a man who spent his life on a ranch. He drives a mud-spattered pickup, wears thick rubber boots and filthy jeans. But he doesn't look like a guy who will cry when he talks about selling off his herd.
It's sad, but it's something that you economically have to do. It's that you also have the guilt pangs because your heritage and everybody worked so hard to build this thing, and you're the one that has to terminate it and let it go. It's humiliating. You're not very proud of yourself when you got to do something like this.
Mendoza's selling his cows through an industry-funded program that aims to ease an oversupply of milk. The program requires dairies to sell their entire herd for slaughter and agree to stop milking cows for at least a year. Mendoza says he's squeezed between competition from mega dairies, the high cost of feed, and the dip in consumer demand. These days, he's earning only about half of what it costs him to produce each gallon of milk.
So when you have a lower price and a greater input cost, you're in big trouble. Hell, we got more farm milk 30 years ago than we're getting now.
That's right. USDA economists project this year's average milk price paid to dairy farmers will be the lowest since 1978. Joey Mendoza says part of the pain of leaving the business is all the other people who will be affected. Eight families work for him on the ranch.
I was raised to be an honorable and fair guy. So when your decision indirectly affects families like that and their kids and their wow, you know, that leaves a bitter taste in your mouth.
Ray Souza is president of Western United Dairymen, which represents about 1,100 California dairy farmers.
When you leave the dairy industry, it's highly emotional, and especially when you're put in a situation where you have no alternative but to leave.
At least two California dairymen have committed suicide in recent months. Souza and others in the industry believe it's at least in part because they were losing their farms. The dairy industry has gotten some help from Washington. The USDA has subsidized farmers with more than $5 million in aid over the last few months to make up for some of the income loss. Back on his ranch, Joey Mendoza says if he can ride out this downturn, he'd think about reopening in a few years as a small organic dairy. He could make more money per gallon for organic milk. Otherwise, he might try and earn a buck renting his scenic farm to dairy industry advertisers. He thinks if they can take pictures of happy cows grazing near the ocean, it might encourage consumers to drink more milk. For NPR News, I'm Sasha Coca.
One of the most powerful players in healthcare is the lobbying group PhRMA, the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturers of America. It represents 32 brand name drug companies and has so much influence that when Congress passes a bill, PhRMA almost always gets its way. NPR's Dollar Politics team dug into the numbers and found one big reason why. PhRMA and its members have spent millions of dollars lobbying Congress at this critical moment in the healthcare debate. Here's correspondent Andrea Seabrook.
Any firm that spends significant money lobbying Congress has to file a quarterly report. This Monday was the deadline for the second quarter, giving us a chance to peer into three critical months in the healthcare debate: April, May, and June. That's when Congress really got down to business. In those 3 months, PhRMA spent just over $6 million, breaks down to about $2 million a month. But then we looked up the reports of the companies that belong to PhRMA, and it turns out that all but a few of them were running their own lobby shops as well. Drugmaker Pfizer alone spent $5.5 million. Amgen, Eli Lilly, and GlaxoSmithKline spent about $3 million each. Add it all up, and you get this. In those three critical months, PhRMA and its member companies spent $40 million lobbying Congress. That's $3 million and change each week. Pharma declined to speak to us for this story, and four of its biggest members turned down or didn't respond to requests for interviews.
We need good coverage people can afford.
But Pharma is running ads.
A little more cooperation, a little less politics, and we can get the job done this time.
And Pharma's CEO, Billy Tozan, has been out there touting its support for reform.
We're working with groups we never worked with before, Families USA, the American Agenda. We're working with labor and healthcare providers that never stood together on the same platform together. We have every business reason to want to see this happen, and we have every moral reason to see it happen because our patients are our first concern.
Of course they're supportive. They're getting from it exactly what they want.
This is Dr. Jerry Avorn, a professor at Harvard Medical School. He, for one, is not shocked to hear that brand-name drug company spent $40 million in 3 months.
It's not surprising to learn this because the pharmaceutical industry has for many, many years been one of the most effective and powerful and expensive lobbying outfits in Washington. And it explains why we have a lot of drug policies in the U.S. that don't look like drug policies in any other industrialized country.
Avorn wrote a book about drugs and healthcare called Powerful Medicines. Avorn compares the current fight to the last time Congress did a major healthcare change in 2003. It added prescription drug coverage to Medicare. He says pharma's lobbying efforts were so vast and so intense that the result is plain in the law. The government is empowered to negotiate how much it pays doctors, hospitals, laboratories, almost anyone who does business with Medicare, anyone except pharmaceutical companies. Avorn points out negotiating drug prices is made illegal by the law. If you want to know what pharma is getting this time, Avorn says, just look at what's not on the table during the debate. Drug reimportation from Canada? Off the table. Government-negotiated drug prices? Off the table.
A lot of those seem to have been already resolved even before the public discussion begins. And usually, as with the other interest groups involved, they seem to have been resolved in favor of the interest groups rather than in favor of the public.
There's something else drug companies bought with that $40 million. People. Pharma alone has 29 people lobbying for it. Dig into the reports and you'll find that it also hired 45 different D.C. lobbying firms to represent it in those 3 months. Check out a graphic of this at NPR.org. Most of the drug companies that belong to pharma are running their own lobby shops as well. Plus, the biggest ones have also hired dozens of D.C. lobbying firms. So think about it this way. There are far more people in Washington representing one party of the debate, the big drug companies, than there are members of Congress working on the health care bill. This is not to pass judgment on the merits of pharma's arguments, but to show just how much money and lobbying it uses to back them up, and the winning streak in Congress that follows. Andrea Seabrook, NPR News, Washington.
We want to hear your questions about fixing health care. We'll find some answers and put them on the air. Send them to us at our website. Go to NPR.org, click on Contact Us, and please put health in the subject line.
However you feel about the health care bill Congress is debating, it would accomplish one thing most people probably agree is good: extending health care coverage to almost every American. Of course, that comes with a price. And the cost, according to the Congressional Budget Office, is about $1 trillion over the next decade. Here to talk about that number and what it means is David Kestenbaum from our Planet Money team. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Linda.
So I think a year ago, $1 trillion would have given people a sticker shock. But after the financial crisis, maybe that number doesn't feel so big. How are we supposed to think about $1 trillion?
It is funny how things change. For me, I can't get my head around $1 trillion. So I asked a guy who does this for a living, Bill Gale. He's an economist at the Brookings Institution.
$1 trillion is definitely a lot of money, even if we are already now spending trillions of dollars on things like the financial bailout, the economic stimulus package, and so on. We shouldn't get inured to the idea that just because we've had to spend that is not a huge amount of money.
So here are some comparisons that might help. So the healthcare bill would be $1 trillion over 10 years. So that's about $100 billion a year. $100 billion a year is 6 times larger than NASA's budget. So you can imagine creating another 5 NASAs.
How would it compare to the Iraq War?
$100 billion a year is roughly ballpark what we are spending on the Iraq War. I think the best comparison is probably to look at what the government is actually spending on health care right now, on Medicare, Medicaid, and subsidies. And that number is about $1 trillion a year. So adding $100 billion a year, that's like a 10% increase in cost. So 10% increase in what you get for that is pretty much universal health care coverage.
Now, President Obama said in his news conference this week that not fixing health care would also be unacceptably expensive.
If somebody told you that there is a plan out there that is guaranteed to double your health care costs over the next 10 years, that's guaranteed to result in more Americans losing their health care, and that is by far the biggest contributor to our federal deficit, I think most people would be opposed to that. Well, that's the status quo.
So there are two challenges here. One is expanding health care coverage, and the bill definitely does that. Just about everybody would have health care coverage. But the second challenge is bringing costs down. And that is the train wreck that is down the tracks, and we still have to deal with it. Here is Kent Smetters, who used to work at the Congressional Budget Office. He's now at Wharton, the University of Pennsylvania's business school.
If we eliminated every single government program, the military, the education, roads, everything except Social Security and Medicare, we would not have enough money left over to pay for Social Security and Medicare.
And of those two, Social Security and Medicare, Medicare is by far the big dog.
But David, aren't you saying that you'd run into that train wreck whether you passed the Obama health care reform or you didn't?
Yeah, that train wreck is coming. And the question is, what does this bill do, or what is the Obama administration planning to do down the road to help rein in costs? Because right now this is going to increase costs, adding more people to the system. And what the Obama administration says is that they do not have a clear plan at this point. That is actually what Peter Orszag said this week. He is the head of the White House Office of Management and Budget. He said there is no complete plan.
It does not exist on Capitol Hill. It does not exist in the bowels of the Institute of Medicine. It does not exist in the Congressional Budget Offices. It does not exist here.
So the health care bill does take some preliminary steps to try to begin restructuring the system so doctors don't prescribe things that patients don't need, to try and put more emphasis on preventative care. But if you ask the Congressional Budget Office, which is seen as the official arbiter here, what kind of savings is this going to get us? The CBO's take is that there's just not a lot of data on what works. It's not clear what the plan is. So at this point, it's hard to say how much we will end up bringing down the cost of health care.
David Kestenbaum is part of our Planet Money team. You can read its blog and download the podcast at npr.org/money. David, thank you.
Thanks, Linda.